It changed me physically. I mean, I had put on weight there. I lost my stamina. I mean, there were just a lot of things that happened there that it was almost as if I got there and I started to like metamorphose into something else.
Talking about UFOs, once you get into this field and you start researching and studying and talking to people who've had an experience, I've had my own, paranormal is a huge factor. The Rendlesham Forest event is how it's classified. I believe it was December 1980. There was a previous event at Bentwaters RAF, and that is my guest Lori Rehfeldt's experience. She didn't even find out there was a second experience until after she read a book. So we're going to go back and recap. But beyond the UFO experience, there's more stuff that happens in that area, and that doesn't always see public light. If you look up paranormal and stuff like that, you'll find some accounts. But this is also about Lori's own experience, having an encounter, and then having that basically bring other elements to the fore, like her own intuition, her own psychic abilities. All right, so that's what we're going to get into. Mantid beings, UFOs, grays. Listen to Lori's story.
In my case, my UFO sighting occurred February of 1980, so it was precursor to the December Rendlesham Forest incident. It was in the same, roughly the same location, except mine happened where it flew over the base, and that was, again, about mid-February 1980, during the early morning, about 3 o'clock in the morning.
In trying to do some research, I picked up some paranormal activity, ghost tales, that kind of stuff in that area. And were you aware of anything like that before you got there?
No. The only thing I heard was that we were in Suffolk County, which is the most haunted county in the world, and there were ghosts, and there was this East End Charlie who would walk the runway. He was a German pilot that crash landed at the RAF Woodbridge runway during World War II, when it was known to be a crash base for any planes flying in over the North Sea, because we were so close to the North Sea. So we would hear stories about him on fire, walking the runway with his head in his arms, and there was a story of a woman with riding a bicycle. She looked like something out of the part of the 19th century, wearing the clothes of that time and riding a bicycle. And she didn't have a face. You know, it was like blonde hair and no face. So
wow.
It was really some creepy things were going. There were a lot of creepy things going on over there. I later on learned about the this crazy man who also haunts the area over near Orford Castle, which is also close to the bases. And I had an experience with that one, except I'm not sure if it was him, you know, it was the Orford guy or if it was something else. I'll explain that later.
Oh, well, that's a tease. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
Okay, so all of this stuff along with the UFO sighting. Now, the things I think are fascinating are that when this first happens and you have, this is wasn't on your checklist of things to do when you were there, how did
right.
you reconcile, I mean, going through it and looking and seeing, describe the experience. What happened?
When I saw the UFO, I had already been stationed at the base for, I would say, almost 2 years, about 18 months. And I had been put through the ringer, mainly because I was a woman in a predominantly male career field. And it was just hard because I was marginalized and treated just really badly. In fact, one of the guys recently contacted me and apologized, which he said, I should take you out to lunch. And I said, no, the apology is more than enough, believe
yeah.
me. So when the UFO incident occurred, I was on patrol over on RAF Woodbridge. We had two bases. It was twin bases, they called them. You had RAF Bentwaters and RAF Woodbridge. And what separated them was part of Rendlesham Forest. So I was on patrol. RAF Woodbridge is probably where most of the crazy activity happened that I experienced over there during that time. there was one incident that I experienced over at Bentwaters, but for the most part, it was the tiny, you know, RAF Woodbridge was a tiny little base. So I'm on patrol with Keith Duffield, and he and I are just trying to keep awake. We're doing our building checks, and one of our checks, we had to go out to East Gate and check the gate to make sure it was locked. So we checked it, it was locked, and then I backed up the truck that we were in over to the East Gate gate check. And I just kind of parked, and I was facing the direction of the North Sea. So I was actually looking east. And we saw a plane coming in, and it looked like it was a white light. It didn't change color, but it was a white light. And the approach, it looked like a cargo plane. It looked pretty big. And I kept looking at the runway to see if the lights would go on. You know, I was looking back and forth, and the lights weren't going on. I'm thinking, this could be dangerous. And I was shocked that, why is the plane coming in at 3 a.m? But I was just thinking, well, the good news is we have to do customs work and do a few things, because it flew in from, it was over the North Sea, so we were thinking it flew in from Germany or someplace. And then it's about 100 yards from where we were, it stopped. It came in, and it just stopped, and it hovered. And we were just, at this point, what was going on is processing something that we didn't expect that. And it, after a while, so it was very close to us, and it was probably about, I'm guessing now, but it was between 25 to maybe 50 feet into the air. Mm. So it was low.
Wow.
I mean, it was getting ready to actually land if it was to be an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And then it did these geometric movements, kind of like the sign of the cross. If you're Catholic, you know,
okay.
It went up, down, left, right. And then it kind of throbbed, and then it burst into three pieces and took a dive toward the runway. And then it arced up, and it went straight into the night sky. The lights just completely, you know, went into the stars, and we didn't see it. I mean, we couldn't track it.
Wow.
But the problem that we had is, this was during the Cold War, and the biggest problem that we had is the fact that it flew over the base. It flew onto military property, and if anything had happened, I would have been responsible for it. And so I had to report it no matter what. And that part got more difficult than actually seeing the UFO.
Yeah.
So I handed the radio over to Keith, and I said, here you go, you got to report it. And he handed it back to me. He said, no, you're the lead patrol, you got to report it.
Oh, geez.
So it's weird. We're doing this thing. And I finally get on this radio, like, police control, this is police 4, be advised that, and I start describing it. There was a plane coming in, and then it stopped, and then the death sergeant, Alan Cohen, who's the one who apologized to me,
mm-hmm.
he said, Rachel, get on, go over to the gate, get on the landline, the gate check, East Gate check. So I thought, well, that's better. Because I'm not broadcasting where like 300 people are listening.
Yeah. Okay.
I go into the gate check, and I start telling him what happened, and he's listening, and I could kind of tell based on his that he was saying to himself, "Rachel, seeing UFOs, this is great."
Yeah.
No,
oh, good.
Speaking. Yeah, uh-huh. I'm totally not happy, because. And for the right reasons, because it did happen what, you know, I thought was going to happen. I was teased relentlessly for the next several weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, Rachel's seeing UFOs. He's hanging out with aliens. I'm like, leave me alone.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So he recommended for me to go to the air tower, for us to go to the air tower and check with them. But we got there, we woke the guy up who was in the tower, and he said, oh, it was probably afterburners from a British aircraft from a different base. And see, this thing didn't make any noise. So I was thinking that when you see afterburners shooting, it's usually, it means there's a sonic boom involved with it. Mm-hmm. It's very, very noisy. And I think this thing didn't make any sound.
Would it have, that guy that you're talking to, would it have woken him up since he was asleep?
Yeah, yeah, but he didn't want to act like he was asleep, even though he was old.
Yeah, but
pretty
yeah,
much, just... yeah, you know, had some drool going down his face. I'm like, and I was just so angry that at that point, because he could have corroborated, yeah, that was crazy what happened there, mm-hmm. you know? And the technology wasn't there for them to actually record it and to actually, I don't know why, but no one thought to contact even the RAF Bentwaters air towers to see if anyone had, you know, if they caught it on radar. And, you know, things were just so much more antiquated back then. And so I left there after finding out that he saw nothing. He didn't see anything. And I was like really, really just irritated and pissed off. It was a cold night to begin with, but now it was daybreak, and I'm standing on the platform, kind of like a patio area that was like second floor up, staring down at my truck and then looking out to the North Sea, just thinking about this whole thing, afterburners, thinking about this UFO, mm-hmm. kind of wishing the UFO would come back so I can ask questions. Say, can you explain to me what you're doing and why you're doing it? And yeah. What's going on? I mean, I really wanted to know. I mean, I wanted to know the story because the light was so bright that you couldn't make out any, you know, the structure of it. Mm-hmm. And even though it was very, very close. So I was looking at, and it was years later that it dawned on me that when the UFO incident occurred, it was at 3 o'clock in the morning in February in England. It stays dark until seven o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. I mean, so there were, I think that we lost about 2 hours. Something, you know, I truly believe that because it was starting to look white and kind of cloudy, like daybreak. And you know, because before that it was pitch dark. I mean, we were out there and it was, you know, it was just,
it took you how long to put that together?
Years, decades. Uh-huh. Yeah. Because I was talking to people about it and I can actually visualize looking out, you know, frustrated that, you know, he's telling me British aircraft and, you know, and I kind of wanted to smack him and,
yeah,
you know, and I was thinking, I'm not stupid. I know what afterburners, what they do, the noise they make.
Yes.
And so, but I just remember also just taking in the view and just looking out, toward in the direction of the North Sea, just looking out over by part of a Rendlesham Forest area. And, you know, just kind of thinking about all the heat that I was going to take, which it was February, so I guess heat wouldn't be such a bad thing. But there's no way that it being close to daybreak. So if I wanted to be conservative, it would be at least minimum 2 hours that we lost. But it was just so subtle. It was the same feeling of, you know, time flies when you're having fun or not having fun. Yeah, oh, where'd the time go, you know?
It was a blip.
So I do believe that some of the things that affected me over the years, probably something happened during that time, too. Mm-hmm. And some people have talked about, have I thought about doing regression? And I'm like, yeah, but I don't want to pay for it, you know? You know, if anybody... Yeah, I'm more than happy to do it to figure out, you know, what was going on.
You posted on your Twitter feed, Left at Eastgate, the book by Larry Warren and Peter Robbins. And this is something you said. woke you and your memories. So
absolutely.
Okay, what about the book kind of opened you up and triggered you?
It was about 1996-97 time frame, and I was working at U.S. Department of Education in D.C. and we just got these computers hooked up to Netscape. I was on Netscape playing around with it, and I typed in, "Oh, let me go down memory lane. Let's type in RAF Bentwaters," because I hadn't really thought about it, and I was just kind of just thinking, "What would I like to know? What's going on?" All of a sudden, is when that book Left at East Gate came out. It came up, and I almost fell out of my chair is the way I felt. And because I buried it, everything that happened to me, everything that happened during that time, I mean, that whole 2 years was, and I spent 27 years in the military, those first 2 years were, I was in a war zone. I felt I was in a really, really bad war, and it really affected me, and, you know, it made me angry in so many ways. When I left, I was like, don't mess with me.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Do not mess with me. You don't understand.
The brick wall is up. You're dead if you do. Uh-huh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah. But I was thinking that the military was, Air Force was better than this. So, you know, being hopeful and optimistic, I just wanted to put that part of my history to rest. I didn't want to think about it. And for the most part, I was pretty successful. I just didn't really talk about it. And because it just brought back really depressing memories. And so all of a sudden when I learned, because I was treated so badly about the fact that I saw the UFO, even though Keith Duffield, a white man, saw it with me, you know, it didn't matter. And so when I heard that it came back, and I knew the people who saw it, that it came back, I was like, oh my God, I think that is good for them. And now they can deal with that and carry the weight on their shoulders of what it was like. I'm really glad. I knew John Burroughs back then. I'm like, I'm really glad he's dealing with it, because It was not a good experience. It was not, you know, it's funny. I would talk to people now and they would tell me, oh, it was a benevolent experience. And I kind of felt like the woman, Kate McKinnon on Saturday Night Live. It's like, where was I? How come I had the bad experience?
Yeah. What happened to me? Well, it sounds for you, it was a proving ground, because this is, you're talking about your career. And that's a whole different animal when people at that time, anybody who said that they saw a UFO, there's ridicule, there's ostracization, there's all sorts of garbage that people who said they saw a UFO had to deal with. And then they had to find a clique of other experiencers, and they didn't call them that at that time, other weirdos.
Right.
You guys can... Yeah, well, and that's the whole thing, because it was deep sixed. It was shoved down so people wouldn't talk about it and share their experiences. And when you're looking at the Condon Report and the stuff that J. Allen Hynek did in terms of making people feel stupid or crazy, and then not only that, broadcasting or putting the PR out there that said this is swamp gas. And right now the big thing is Chinese lanterns. Oh, it's a Chinese lantern, because people seem to have figured out that phrase. But that, I think, like going back to the proving ground of saying, how much do you believe in yourself to get over all this garbage they're throwing at you? And that was a huge challenge, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it definitely made me really determined that I was going to, even though by that point these people that I dealt with that then, they were gone, you know, they went to different bases or whatnot and went on with their lives. And I was determined. I got my degree while I was on active duty. I got my commission finally. So I mean, I was going to prove to all these people that treated me so poorly back then that, you know, I was not one to reckon with, because, you know, I wasn't going to quit.
Yeah.
You know, so it's interesting how, you know, it did motivate me that way. However, it did leave a lot of scars.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd blame quite a bit of my PTSD on it, you know, the whole thing. And that particular thing, I wasn't really, really, you know, people said, it must have been exciting to see a UFO. I'm like, no, not really. I said to them, let me just tell you this. If Jesus Christ had come up to me and told me the meaning of life, I'd have to send him to the public affairs office because no one would believe me. I realized that. So some people said to me, well, did they put you under sodium pentothal? Did they do all this stuff to me? And I said, no, because I was already marginalized and I was already under the magnifying glass with the leadership there, that if I made the wrong move, they would have railroaded me out of the military. I mean, they were kicking people out at the 81st Security Police Squadron left and right. And so if you stood out or if you questioned something and they said, don't do that, and you continued to do that, you were gone. Mm-hmm. And we had a huge, we've had groups like of airmen being processed out, and you know, one day they're there, next day from my vantage point they disappeared because they were pretty much packy bags. You're going back home to the States, and that's that.
Did anyone tell you not to talk about it?
No, they didn't have to, because I just kind of knew that it wouldn't do any service to me to even discuss it. Mm-hmm. So it's funny because I was kind of thinking it would draw more negative attention to me. So I was just in a different situation than when it happened in December. Now I had left 2 weeks earlier, so I was unaware that it came back 2 weeks after I was gone. I mean, I was still kind of, you know, processing and grieving my time where I left and you know, and how I felt like I was always on guard, always looking over my shoulder, and also grieving over the fact that, you know, John Lennon had recently died, and it was during, you know, so, and I'm back home in New York. So
wow.
There was just a lot going on, and part of me wanted to just move forward, go to my next base, which was at Lowry Air Force Base in Denver. And I ran into a sergeant there, Sergeant Campos, who was one of the flight chiefs at Bentwaters. And I went up to him and I asked him, that was the only time that I asked anyone, what happened there? You know, because everything about me was in a war zone, and I felt like I was being, you know, torn apart from the inside out. And a lot of it was like the whole atmosphere was so off. And he looked at me with a strange smile and he said, oh, it was a great time. I had a great time there. And so it dawned on me again, don't pursue it, Lori, mm-hmm. because he, it's almost like he's saying, back off.
Right.
And it could be that, maybe I'm intuitive. So, and a lot of the people there are more or less, just give me the facts, just mm-hmm. give me this. And, you know, so I'm thinking that, well, maybe all these people did have a really good time and I'm just kind of like, you know, just feeling something, but it was just really, I mean, it changed me physically. I mean, I had put on weight there. I lost my stamina. I mean, there were just a lot of things that happened there that it was almost as if I got there and I started to like metamorphose into something else. My mom came to visit me and she didn't even recognize me. So there was just a lot of things that was just pretty crazy.
Wendy's Coffee House, wake up and smell the... Let's take a quick break. A lot of people have tried to figure out the backstory, if it was a military thing, if it was done intentionally, all that good stuff. But the stuff you're describing, the physical after effects, especially if you were that close, you're saying 25 to 50 feet above you, that's a really, really close proximity to that kind of energy. If you were indeed with that time, that missing time, man, that's, if there's any way for you to do a regression to figure out if you could connect the dots, it might help with some of the PTSD and some of the other stuff to understand that when people are in close proximity, the research, the studies they've done, it does change some people and it triggers, you know, it triggers you. So did you become in any way more intuitive or more sensitive? Do you feel that at all, aside from the other physical fallout?
Yeah, I would definitely say that. I had the intuition. I had an experience when I was a little kid, about third grade, about eight, 9 years old. I went through Catholic school, and I look over through these double doors and into this room that was, we called it the all-purpose room. And I saw this huge statue of Mary, the mother of Jesus. And I passed another set of doors and it was gone. And I'm thinking, you know, what happened? Where did the statue go? Or I see, and I was thinking in terms of statue as opposed to, even though it was lifelike. And I told my mom when I got home about it, and she immediately called my grandmother, who was living in Ireland at the time, and told her, Lori had a sighting and whatnot. So I went back and that was, 1968 or 69. And then I went back to St. Patrick's Church in Smithtown. And I went up to some of the people and told them about my experience. And one of them said that others have had feelings that she was there, the mother of Jesus, and that's my old Catholic stuff coming out, mother of Jesus and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. But there was a spirit in my house. It was in the basement, and it was a real negative, evil energy. You know, so I had that growing up, and to the point that I could hear it. I could hear the laughter coming from it, and. Yeah, so I've had these kinds of experiences and I wish I didn't have it because I would get scared, you know. I was like, not seeing Mary, that was amazing because the colors were so vibrant. The other experiences, and then when I got to England, I didn't want them to know that there were areas that I was scared. I didn't want to really work, but I had to because I couldn't show them I was scared. You know, you got to be macho. So, I mean, they had it where East Gate was open 24/7 when I first got there. And then they shut it down at night because hardly any cars came through the gate. But when I first got there, I had to sit out there. And I remember once feeling like this ghostly face behind me. But I wouldn't turn around. It kind of told me in my mind, don't turn around because I don't want to scare you and that kind of thing. So that happened, the gray, and I had another experience with a colonel who had died, but he was at East Gate, but it was another weird situation because he wasn't wearing his hat, and I knew if the patrol came by, they'd yell at me if I didn't tell him to put his hat on, but then he was gone. I'm looking down this perimeter road that there's no way he could have gotten past me without me seeing him. Mm-hmm. If it was like a fence on one side and then this open field where the runway was. And it turned out it was Colonel Thompson who had died in an air show a few months earlier. Yeah, so that was the other one. And the third one I had was, and this happened over the time I was there. The first one was at Bentwaters, I would go by the locks, the liquid oxygen area, to check the gate. And they made you get out of the truck because sometimes they would put a sign or they'd put a note behind the gate so they'd know if you got out of your truck and said, just looked at it from sitting behind the driver's seat. And so I'd get out, run out, and go, get back in because I really felt that there was something like evil, something crazy, like I call him the crazed man and the swamp man. And I knew that there was a pond or some water that was on the other side of the fence, which would have been off base. This was in the area that they called it the Ivy Lodge Gate area. I just knew that there was something there. And it was, again, many years later, I'm looking at Google Maps and or Google Earth. And sure enough, there's a pond there. Mm. I'm like, holy mackerel, you know. I probably said something else, but I'm like, you know, this intuition thing, sometimes it's scary. I mean, I don't, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes I have to say, you know, there's something to it. Then I find out, because we had a serious alcohol problem on the base that was worse than any other base I was stationed at. I mean, young airmen were really literally turning into alcoholics. About not even half a mile from where they were living in the dormitories, there was this old Rendlesham Hall that they had torn down, but it had been used in like the early 1920s as a place for inebriates or people who have drug and alcohol problems lived there. So I really thought maybe this crazed man, maybe he drowned, maybe he got something happened, or he could have been from Orford Castle because they talk about someone who looked similar at the time. The only one I physically saw with my eyes was the colonel, the ghost.
Without his hat.
But the others, it was more in my mind. It was like a fit blast or kind of, you know, it would tell me something, don't go or something like
yes.
that. The other one that was really, really creepy, and these are things that I did not talk about because I instant discharge from
yes.
the military.
Yeah, safety.
And the one that was probably the scariest was the he was about 8-9 feet tall. It was a praying mantis, kind of a very, very muscular. And this was over at Woodbridge in the what we call the non-nuclear munition storage area. I was walking out to check my buildings inside this area that I was actually locked into the area. I had a key, but we had to lock the fence. So I was inside the fence and I was walking to the, where the bombs were kept in these shelters. And I, all of a sudden I got this flash in my head of this almost dark black praying mantis walking, very muscular legs and very, you know, just, you know, and he said, don't go. And I went back to my gate track. I said, okay.
Okay, thanks. Don't mess with big guy. Okay,
yeah.
So that's another one that, you know, people have described as an alien or ET that they have experienced, these mantid beings. So it's fascinating that you're picking up on that in that area without knowing firsthand that there is any activity mm-hmm. to start out with.
Right, right. And I didn't know, you know, this whole mantid thing, this was one thing that I never, I mean, back in 2000 when I did the disclosure, I was still on active reserves. I was a captain at the time, and I did not talk about, there were still things that I did not want to talk about because it was just, I just thought it was just
too far
unbelievable
out.
And too creepy, you know, and I really didn't, again, want to draw that kind of attention to me, but
well,
I wanted answers for
yeah.
sure.
There are people who are researching experiencers who have told their stories and trying to get the word out that some of this stuff is more real than we have been led to believe. And the reason they haven't talked about it is because they don't know how it works or what it's for, or, you know, like you, why did that happen? The BBC had a what was this? I think 2020, going back and looking at the Rendlesham experience. Let me see mm-hmm. what the title is. Rendlesham Forest UFO, Are We Any Closer to the Truth 40 Years On? On this site is a drawing from Mr. Burroughs. I have to scroll down to find it. Okay. From John Burroughs. It mm-hmm. also shows him with his beautiful German Shepherd. He's got the drawing of what
yeah.
he saw. The red, the orange, the blue lights. You have a dog too, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm actually outside, but I'm gonna walk him inside. Yeah, he's a diva. He's a little habanese. So he, okay, so he, yeah, he's a pain. He's like Velcro dog. He's my trainer.
I have one barking in the other room like, okay, be quiet. Cassie, be quiet. I hope I don't have to edit.
Oh.
I'll leave it in. It's called character.
Okay.
Here, so the light that he has a triangle, December 26, 1980, the sketch that he drew, there is a triangle at the top of this triangle on the picture that I'm looking at is a circle. And he says the circle there is red and orange. And there are four circles within the triangle. And the four circles, he said, they're blue lights. They would blink on and off inside the beam, and the beam would be red. So he had multiple colors.
I had heard that. And the strange thing is, too, is that back in 97, when I learned about it, came back, I remember drawing, I had some color pencils, and I drew a triangle with one orb outside of it, the triangle, and one at the bottom attached to it. I'll send you the photo.
Okay.
Not the photo, but the picture I drew.
Yeah.
And then separately, Larry Warren had a picture that he did, and it was the same thing. So there is something about a triangle and circles that seems to be imprinted in our minds or in something. I also have these recurring dreams. I mean, I dream that the sky turns into a grid, and all of a sudden it's like a wake up. It's like there's all this activity that we can't see with the naked eye, but you know, if we look through, I guess, our mind's eye, there's a whole lot of stuff going on.
You know what? I've had dreams since I was a kid about grids, about getting beyond the, if we go out in a rocket and get beyond the zone that we are kind of limited at seeing, and then everything else outside that zone is a grid. So everything here is all that we are working with, and the outside.
Yeah.
And there are even billboards telling the spaceships, you know, do not go.
Wow.
But there are billboards with information on the billboards, signposts outside this area, and the rest, and that's a grid. And I thought, well, you know, so it's funny that you're saying, you know, that image, because that brings us back to the Matrix, you know, so amazingly enough.
Well, and in my dream, this is over by East Gate. It's over in that area.
Mm-hmm.
It's at Woodbridge. Yeah.
Well, so it says there's more going on there than we can access. That grid is a different dimension.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that, you know, personally, I think that there's a war going on that we can't see with our mind. I mean, there's something over there that's really, and historically, I'm sure there's been a lot of bloodshed on that land. The other thing that's interesting is that Pleiades has a piece in this too. And it's... there's this place called Sutton Hoo, about half a mile from Eastgate. And they have these mounds that are shaped like the star cluster of Pleiades. And on top of it, see, some of my dreams would take me, I was explaining to some people about being on a desert road. Like one minute I'm in England and I'm trying to tell people I don't belong here. I'm not here. I don't belong here. And they want me to get work and get on the gate, you know. I'm like, no, I don't work here. And so they put me on East Gate, I take that back. And then I'm driving around, and then before I know it, I'm on a desert road, and I'm heading into this desert, and I come upon this pond, and it's aqua color. There's something peaceful about it, but it's butted up against these brown dirt mountains. And it's, but something about the water, it's salt water, it's like tranquil. And I, put my feet into the water, the whole thing. And then I keep having the same dream over and over, you know, almost every night.
Mm-hmm.
And then I get a complimentary copy of National Geographic magazine. And this happened in 96, 97. So that's why I consider that whole time it's like an awakening.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh my God, I was bombarded with all these coincidences and messages. And so I was thumbing through the magazine. I'm staring at the pond that's in my dream. And I'm thinking, oh my God, this is crazy. It turns out it's in this place. It's probably about 40 or 50 miles most from this other place called the Zone of Silence in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And it's known for Pleiadians actually are out there and they're helping people. If you get stuck in the desert, I guess, you know, you can't start your car there. I guess they're mechanics or something. But they are there to help you. And they're really tall and they're the blonde haired people, that kind of thing.
Wow.
So that kind of blew my mind that there are all these other connections. And the Zone of Silence is in line with the Bermuda Triangle and all these other places. So they're all correlating together. And then, you know, the more you read, then you realize that, you know, Atlantis is part of this whole story. And that's where the Pleiadians are part of it. And, you know,
get with the grid, which would be, you know, trying to connect the dots of how these places are all woven together.
And often I'm trying to process. I'm just trying to see. I'm just one person, and I know that if I share my story, others can kind of help dissect it or zoom in on different aspects of it and say, "Lori, this is what's going on. And this is important. And this, you know, and I possibly think it could help humanity, because I really think that the powers to be out there, the universe, is really, they're not here to save us." And I'm not saying that in a bad way, that they're evil or anything like that. They're upset with us because of the way we are taking care of this gem called Earth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need, and I don't ever think that we're going to see what we need to see, because people have to learn to be kind and generous. I mean, there's things that they have to do that are really considered. You want a nuclear bomb? Well, let me tell you, the best nuclear bomb to get out there is to be kind. That should be your sword, be your weapon. I think at that point, they'll come to us.
Adolescents. The adolescents.
Oh, my God.
You know.
No. We want to take them and kill them.
Uh-huh,
I mean, we want to. If they say, welcome, we're so glad to be here, and we would be like, okay, we're gonna kill you, and then we're gonna dissect you and figure out what you are.
Instead of it doesn't work with the frogs either. You don't know anything more about a frog when you've killed it. So this is basically a process, and that's what I wanted to get into, was the fact that, you know, you also included the things that you had from childhood, the awareness that came with you, and then basically the dark night of the soul, going into the military and being told, you know, you have no value, no worth, and yet seeing the UFO that says, okay, well, here's the wild card, you got this. And so now when things are beginning to open up and loosen up in terms of talking about it, and our government, the U.S. government, basically starting to sign off on, okay, yeah, we were trying to keep this thing quiet, but obviously the cat's out of the bag, so we'll talk about it now, and we'll even study it. We'll tell you some of that. We won't tell you everything, because you're not old enough to know. don't know what you're going to do with this stuff.
Yeah, and the other problem is that the people say it, the whole Rendlesham thing, whether a lot of people that want to keep it to those 3 days, they don't want to include these other, Steve LaPlume had his own UFO experience out by Eastgate. There's this huge aircraft floated over him and this other guy. He wrote a book called Rendlesham and Redemption, yeah, something like that. And I think that people have to accept the fact that what John Burroughs experienced is very different than what Tennyson experienced, and that's okay. Because what I experienced is completely different too, and that's okay. But they're all part; they all belong together, because we were meant to see things differently.
Yes.
And you know,
yes.
And people are saying, "Well, what about he? You know, Tennyson's coming up with these X and O's and whatnot, and it's and how come now? Why now?" And it's like, because now is when it was supposed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't supposed to happen then.
Well, and I agree. The other thing, too, is that just because your experiences don't match identically, each of you has your own frame of reference, your own ideology, your own perspective, your own way of viewing things. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't match that we all see the same thing at the same time in the same way. And that's why you have people who are linear, people who are more visual, kinetic, all that. And if we draw a picture, some of us can't draw. So our picture isn't going to match somebody else who's got a photographic memory and the ability to draw. And that's the problem when they come into this thing. Well, yours, you know, your account is so weird, we can't accept it. It's like, no. The account is valid. it's our way of contextualizing and trying to make it match everyone else's that is off base, off center.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think, and I think the hard part is that, you know, about 5-6 years later, I'm still in the Air Force and I'm stationed at the Defense Systems Management College at Fort Belvoir. And they had us take the Myers-Briggs test. And at the college, this psychiatrist that was administering the test after it was over, he asked me, out of all these hundreds of people, to come to his office. And we were talking, and he was just trying to figure out how I was able to survive being in the military. He goes, you know, your intuition is, it's off the chart. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, and then he would start saying things to me, and I really thought he knew me, you know, and I almost started crying because I was like, I know. And it dawned on me, I mean, to me that was, because everyone else was these sensing, thinking type, and I'm this like feeling and intuition. I mean, you know, my sensitivity is so strong, and I know that's been probably my, like a magnet or an antenna to the unknown that's out there. I mean, if I, like mentioned earlier about some of the, what I would call gifts that I have, is I can go into a place and see, well, I call them angels, but they're, it's almost as if somebody's getting ready to die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this happened several times. I'd walk into a place and it would be warm, and I'm supposed to be there for one thing, like selling insurance. And I walk into this room and I'm like, I'm not here to sell insurance. I'm here to tell her that it's okay to go. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I'm like, oh my God, this is crazy. And I look at this woman and I ask her, and I did this like 3-4 times it happened. And I'm like, I guess somebody else has a different plan for me. And
yes.
I asked her, I said, is this room crowded with people like angels? And the woman's just smiling serenely, like, yeah, they're there, you know? And then I go back to that same place. In this case, it was it was a place for people that were on poverty level. And so mm-hmm. I went back to this building, and the room was vacated. She had passed away a couple of days after I was there. And I purposely, I said, do you mind if I step in that room? And I just wanted to step in to see if I still felt the same thing I felt when she was there, mm-hmm. and how it was crowded. And it was warm. It was empty. They all vacated. So, you know, those are the types of, yeah.
Yes.
The kinds
yes.
of things that happen to me now.
And that's okay for it to happen to you now. That's the cool thing. But I tell you what, the group that you were with, in order to get to bridge this kind of material to that kind of mindset, it has to be somebody who's been in the trenches. Because you speak a different language. You speak a different, from a different vantage point of knowing what it was like to be, you know, under the gun, literally. And you were
yeah.
responsible. If that needed to be reported, you had to take the fall, and you survived.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, I appreciate you saying that.
Well, it just, sometimes we wonder why us? Why
yeah,
me?
Yeah.
I'm not ready. And that, you know, that thing of, well, you're
yeah.
not ready, but you're prepared, whether you know it or not. And that's part of what you bring to this. And not only that, then talking about these things that happened afterwards, where, mm-hmm. you know, you've had something that challenged you and raised, I think probably rewrote your DNA at that time, just, you know, whether you felt it or not.
I think so.
Something happened.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I think so. I think so. I mean, yeah, you hit it right on the head.
We don't always talk about this stuff, but it needs to be talked about for other people mm-hmm. who are trying to connect their own dots and saying, why doesn't this make sense? And then the aha moment hits when it's supposed mm-hmm. to, because then you're ready to
yeah.
integrate it and say, okay, now I can deal with it. Where before, it might have caused all sorts of trauma. And because it wasn't okay, but once you understand, okay, this is who I am as a person, and these are the parts of me that I'm okay with now. I can handle
oh, yeah.
it. And that's what you're doing now.
Yeah, I've actually pretty much probably spent the last 20 years since I've retired from the military, just really trying to get my story out, because I think there's a few things going on. One is they need to hear from more women. I think that
yes.
the whole story, it's just taken up mostly by a bunch of white men. I'm sorry, but it is what it is.
They're okay with it. I mean, they have permission to talk about it without losing. I mean, yes, excuse me, but maybe John Mack did lose a lot. There's a precedent set where it's okay to hear it from a white male, but when a woman is, well, you already are intuitive, you already have the woo-woo mm-hmm. thing going, and, you know, it's no big deal.
Yeah.
Wrong, especially with your military background, it brings a whole different element into play.
And I remember, you know, when in 97, around that time frame, when I first found out, it was like an awakening. Like, all of a sudden, it gave me that chance to, I need to know what the hell happened then. Because what happened there really greatly transformed me. It shaped me. It changed me in so many ways. And it wasn't something that I could just run away from. And so one of the people I talked to was Nick Pope. And he told me he worked for MOD, and I was thinking, for some reason, I just jumped to the fact that he was at MOD in 1980, because this was 1997, you know, so I figured, you know, it wasn't that long. And for some reason, he never corrected it, you know. I mean, he had ample time to, oh, wait, no, I was working for MOD in 1985, I did hear about it, but I was really needing to want to talk to somebody there who was there in 1980 to figure out what they did and what they, you know. And the way I found out was I was looking something up, and I found out that he was born about 5 years, 4 years after me, or 5 years, and that would have made him 15 during that time frame. And it just really, you know, I guess I felt betrayed. I felt really upset about it. And since then, and it's been going on for a while now, I've learned that there are people out there, and unfortunately, he's probably on the top of the list of people that they listen to. And I really think this is so important for this part to come out, is that there are people that are the Nick Popes out there that are doing such a disservice to the experiencers. He's blocked me. He won't even talk to me on like Twitter or anything like that. And the reason being, and so he's reshaped the story of Rendlesham and put himself into it. And even at, I think, one of his conferences, he shows a picture of East Gate. And I'm like, no, that's not the East Gate that was there. So he's giving information, whether it's small or large. You know, they said, well, he was in charge of MOD. There's a bunch of papers out there that said, no, he was in charge of the copy machine or something, you know. And but he doesn't change it. And, you know, so I'm really kind of hypersensitive of some of these people that call themselves, you know,
experts.
Especially the ones.
Yes, experts. Yeah.
And the ones who are, I'm still kind of, I got a bad vibe about Lou, but I'm not sure. But again, that intuition I have, I hate to say it, it's been on the money like 90% of the time.
Some people have to walk a very fine line in terms of getting information out and also providing a service for someone who remains unseen. There's an agenda. Go with your intuition and then see where it leads. But that, for me, is what I've had to do mm-hmm. to understand, especially doing media, in the background of, all right, I'll take it at face value to start out with, and then I'm going to look to see mm-hmm. what's under the rock and see why. You know, what's the purpose? What's the point? Where's the agenda? Who benefits and who is unseen? Because just like our universe where we see everything on the surface, there's that grid that's under the surface with the mantid beings waiting to say, gotcha.
Wake up. Yeah. And I guess the thing is that you've got people who have information. I mean, I've been at it trying to get my story out for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of people will tell me, you know, it's only been recently I heard about you.
Yes.
I mean, I don't have that many people on Twitter who are, you know, people, they don't go looking for me. But then you get these, you know, I hate to say it, you get these white men, and all of a sudden, man, you know, You got the British accent. That even helps even more.
I know. Yeah, and okay. I know. It's that exotic thing. Okay, but go back to this. From the beginning, what my information has always been is it isn't the numbers. It's the quality. So when you do have a contact or a connect, there is more authenticity with that than there is in having 50 million followers, because a follower is not going to get you anywhere. But somebody who's an experiencer, who's been around the block a time or two and connect with you, gives you authentic, valid, and valuable information. Mm-hmm. So know that when somebody does find you, there's a reason. And let that speak for itself. Yeah. I had you on my list. And when I found you on Twitter, I'm like, oh my gosh, I posted you on my blog. Yes, I've got that. Let's connect. You know, I was so glad to see you on Twitter. And I'm glad you're getting your story out. And not only that, that you have had a chance to really go through and unpack it, because that's what this stuff does to you. You can't just say, well, this is what happened. It's like, oh my gosh, there's context, there's texture and depth.
Yeah.
And it continues to unfold.
Talking to folks like yourself, it really draws out more information out of me, but it also gives me some solace and peace and comfort, knowing that there are people that understand and probably are far more knowledgeable than I am about my own experiences, which is kind of strange to say, but it really, it helps me heal. And so that's why I reach out to folks.
I think it's great that you are talking, because until we connect the dots with our stories, this stuff is going to sit there and smolder and percolate. And then you get the disinformation that's like, well, where do we go for the authentic stuff? And that's right here in front of us.
Yeah. You know, I'll just share this one other story, because the synchronicities just seems to happen it happens in groups. I can go for months and not feel anything. And all of a sudden it's like something triggers the synchronicity, and it's just like a dominoes falling.
Yeah.
And I was talking to a friend of mine from my time over in England, who I kept in Texas. This is about 97 again. And I told her, oh my God, it came back. And, you know, it was like the floodgates that opened for me. And she said, you know, you have got to read this book, The Philistine Prophecy. And I said, I said, okay, I'll check it out. I'm open to any ideas. So I left work, and I walked from my work to Union Station. And I played a game where I try and catch up to this person that's like three blocks ahead of me. And, you know, usually I don't pass them or whatnot, but it keeps me entertained. Mm-hmm. So I'm walking, I'm getting closer and closer and closer. Now we're in Union Station, but she's only about 5 feet ahead of me. But now she'd make the beeline into the bookstore where I was planning on going to get a copy of the book, The Philistine Prophecy. And now I'm looking at the book, trying to figure out what section it's in. And I look over, and it's kind of weird. Now I'm kind of feeling like I'm following her. And but I'm still looking at the books. And sure, I look at her because I knew she's in the area where the book was. She pulls out the book, The Philistine Prophecy. That was the first book and only book. She pulls it out, and she looks at it for about 20 seconds. I mean, she just looked at it. She put it back, and then she walked out. And I thought, this is just too much.
Oh, that's excellent. Yes. Yeah. And that, you wonder, okay, was that a real person?
Yeah. Didn't even think of that. My sister said to me, well, did you ask her? Did you ask her why she pulled that book? I said, no, she was a stranger. And I was under a time crunch to get onto the train. And, but the thing was, it was like that. I mean, there are hundreds of books in that store. Why
Absolutely.
That one? Yeah. Why now?
Yeah. You know, it's like, okay, if you needed any validation, there it is. There it is. Somebody did it for you. Yeah, this stuff is real. It's real. And we are given, to me, that's like a Matrix moment where, you know, there's something else beyond what we are consciously aware of that leads us to the places we need to be. And, you know, like when you said the mantid being said, don't go there. People have this negative thing of anything that doesn't look like a human could be bad. Well, some humans are pretty awful and they look fantastic. You can't judge a book by its cover. And I think that's part of what this is trying to demonstrate. is you can't put a label on this stuff. You have to learn how to use your intuition and expand your awareness. Otherwise, you're basically incompetent in terms of dealing with what we're going to be dealing with in the next 10 years.
Yeah, there's like this level or this, in order to get to the next level, whether it's the use of mental telepathy or anything like that.
We have to wrap, and I will include pictures and images. I'll include those on the blog, Talking to Nightlights WordPress, and I'll include those pictures. Really fascinating, the stuff that happens beyond those UFO sightings. And so that, a lot of times, isn't included in the stories. You have to go look under paranormal or UFO or supernatural to pick up that other anomalous experience stuff that happens in the Rendlesham area. Lori and her sister Donna Schreiber have a YouTube channel, God, Aliens, and a Cup of Coffee. You can check that out. Again, that's on YouTube. Thanks for listening. Stay curious.